Joyce asked me to introduce Keith, as she said, we do know each other reasonably well. Keith lives in Southampton, where he's a professor at the University of Southampton, but he is, as you've seen on the screen and just heard, associate director of the Faraday Institute for Science and Religion in Cambridge. Keith was chair of Christians in Science from 2007 to 2013. And during this time, Keith secured a major grant from the John Templeton Foundation, and our ministry at CIS expanded quite considerably through that, and he still serves as one of the trustees. He's editor of the journal Science and Christian Belief, and he's a founder member of the very successful CIS local group in Southampton. However, he's just told me that the food here is much better. Keith is also a lay reader and preacher at his local church. Academically, Keith studied natural sciences at Cambridge, did his PhD there, and was a research associate and fellow there until he was appointed as a lecturer at the University of Southampton. He became professor of biochemistry in the year 2000 and leads a research group that studies nucleic acids. He was acting head of biological sciences, part of the Faculty of Natural and Environmental Sciences, in 2012 and 13. He's published many research articles on DNA and is senior executive editor of the world-renowned journal Nucleic Acids Research. From all this, you'll see that Keith is ideally placed to speak to us on the subject God and DNA. Over to you, Keith.
Thank you, Joy, and thank you, Hugh, for your generous welcome. Hugh may have tried to embarrass me. I tell you that he was treasurer of CIS and therefore did all the work in looking after the money that was raised. Raising the money was very easy compared to administering, I tell you. I've for 30 years and more been interested in researching DNA, and for more than 30 years have been a committed Christian who wants to integrate my science and my faith together. So this evening I want to fascinate you with the molecule DNA, to really express a little bit of awe and wonder of that molecule, and to raise some questions of faith, and particularly Christian faith, with respect to that. The biological scientist who looks at molecules, in terms of the scriptures, is not very well off, because the scriptures don't know about molecules, do they? But they do know. Now, for those of you who thought you'd sit at the back and avoid the speaker, unfortunately, my remote control won't reach from front to the back, so occasionally I will walk down through so as to make the remote work. And then it works too well. The scriptures speak very well for those who are involved in astronomical sciences. And when I look at the heavens, the work of your hands, the moon, the stars which you have set there, the heavens declare the glory of God. So if you work on the big scale, the psalmist is very helpful for the Christian. But I want to say that if the psalmist had the ability to look at molecules, then the psalmist too would have looked down at these wonderful molecules. There are various illustrations of different forms of DNA on that slide that I might take you through some of them. When I work, consider your heavens, when I consider the things you've done on the microscopic scale, the work of your fingers, the moon, etc. And so as we go through this, I want you to be amazed at the small things in the same way as the psalmist was amazed at the very big things. Now let's see if we can get on to the next one. So here's our molecule. You're probably well familiar with seeing that, even if you don't know anything about DNA itself. It's frequently there in newspapers, often back to front, but we won't go into that. It is a right-handed helix, and newspapers often present it as a left-handed helix. And it is somewhat of an icon of our age, recognized by so many people. So you think of the ways in which DNA has appeared in all sorts of things. So it appears on stamps. Well, you might expect stamp collectors like and celebrating that sort of thing. On the bottom right-hand corner there is a perfume, which takes the name of DNA, and you can see it's in a helical bottle, and it is actually sold for him or for her. It's a US product, you might guess. Somehow on the top left-hand corner, DNA is involved with marketing. I do not get the link, but somehow it is. So it's used in all sorts of ways as an image. Go back one from that. How many times have you heard the phrase, it's in their DNA? So corporations, industries, it's in their DNA. Churches even say sometimes things are in their DNA. They can't escape from it. Look at the sort of things that are blamed on DNA and genes. And these are some quotes that my colleague Dennis Alexander has taken from various newspapers at times. The love cheat gene, the gangster gene, the mean gene, genes to hormones, cigarette ciggies. No, it's in your DNA to smoke. It isn't actually. The gluttony gene, the liberal gene, the happiness gene. Somebody wrote to The Guardian and suggested there might be something called the geneticism gene, which is a gene that predisposes some people to think that there is a gene that that predetermines the way they behave. And companies use it. I just picked this randomly off the internet, a Canadian university saying it's in their DNA that their alumni naturally give. One of my good marketing tools. Build on great relationships, the liberal family tree, it's in their DNA. I want to, if you're involved in any form of public speaking, of preaching or whatever, can I ask you please never to use that phrase? Because it rather suggests that everything's predetermined, there's no escape from the way that our genes dictate we're going to be. Genes affect us, they do limit some of the things that we do, but it's not a determinism. Things are not written down. DNA actually isn't a blueprint. It might be an instruction manual, but it's not a blueprint. There is still a free will. So if you only learn one thing this evening, for those involved in public speaking, please don't say it's in their DNA. Let me give you a little history about DNA for those who are maybe not up to speed with the science. Actually, if I said to you who discovered DNA, I bet most of you would say Watson and Crick, 1953. They actually discovered the structure of DNA. It was first discovered by this character, Friedrich Miescher, in the 19th century, who actually extracted it from suppurating wounds. He used to go around collecting bandages from hospitals and collect the pus from them and extract various molecules. Not very pleasant thing to talk about on a nice evening after you've had very, very pleasant food. And a good example of the way science worked is actually he tried to publish it. He went to his boss and said, I found this wonderful molecule that contains oxygen, phosphorus, nitrogen, and hydrogen, and no sulfur. And his boss said, I don't believe you. And actually his boss had to repeat the experiments before he'd allowed him to publish these things. It wasn't recognized as genetic material initially. Way until maybe the 1940s, people thought that proteins were your genetic material. Proteins are very diverse. Some are spherical, some are cylindrical, some are long rods, some are very floppy, and it looks as though that maybe that would be the genetic material. DNA is very, I hesitate to say it, but it's very boring. It's just a long polymer. It repeats this A, G, C, and T. No, nothing distinctive as you look at it from the outside. One bit looks very much the same as another. And it's some pioneer experiments in the 1940s and the 1950s that demonstrated that DNA really is your genetic material. Another lesson we learn from DNA is that sometimes eminent scientists get it very wrong. You're familiar with Watson and Crick and their standard model of DNA that I've already showed you. Linus Pauling, who won a Nobel Prize for other things, predicted the structure of DNA, and he actually had it as a three-stranded molecule, and he had it completely inside out. All the things that we know are inside, he put on the outside, and all the things that we put on the outside, he put on the inside. So he got it wrong, but the nice thing about science is it's self-correcting. And that scientists subsequently showed that's not the way it works, that's not consistent with the data, it's actually this nice helical structure. And so in 1953, Watson, Crick, in their really amazing discovery of the structure of that, and their famous paper published in the journal Nature, And one or other of them is reputed to have said in the Eagle Pub in Cambridge, gloating of what they've done, "We have discovered the secret of life." I don't want to pour scorn on that. I think DNA, it really is fascinating. It does get me out of bed in the morning to go and research things on it. But I think there is actually more to the secret of life than DNA itself. They discovered something about the secret of how life worked metabolically, genetically, how it could be inherited. Lots of things about the mechanism of life. But there is a lot more to life itself than just a long polymer. And we know now a lot more about DNA. We've now sequenced the human genome, the first draft released in 2000, subsequent other drafts more recently. And it's interesting that when that sequence was first made public in a great announcement joint between Downing Street and the White House, President Clinton, it was a Clinton in the US, we'll wait and see what happens this evening, they could not avoid the God word. So Clinton says, "Today we are learning the language in which God created life. We're gaining ever more awe for the complexity, the beauty, the wonder of God's most divine and sacred gift." And Francis Collins, who was the director of the Human Genome Project that had been successful in doing that, and himself a committed Christian, said, "It's humbling for me and awe-inspiring to realize that we have caught the first glance of our own instruction book, previously known only to God. We as human beings are the only species on the planet that sequenced our genome. Nothing else has. And we sequence lots and lots of other genomes as well. How much of our DNA and how much of our personality, how much of our personalities can we blame on our genes and our DNA? I guess that quite a number of you have at various times been interested in genealogy, yes? Right? And you know, trace back your parents and your grandparents, and you wonder, what of my character is can be blamed on them? I have white hair. I went white in my early 30s. It's my mother's fault, and it was her father's fault, maternal grandfather. So I look through here, various generations in my family, six male generation lines. How much can I blame on my father, my grandfather, my great-grandfather, etc.? And look at those. See, what inherited characteristics? Well, some are not inherited. If you look at the slide there, the two on the bottom have bow ties, the two in the middle have neckties, and the two at the top have no ties. You will notice that five of those, the five older ones, all wear glasses, and the younger one, my son at the top there, doesn't. So what things are inherited and what are not? You travel on some train journeys and you'll see an advert for a company called 23andMe. You send them a few scrapings of cheek cells and they will analyze your genome and tell you, you know, what recessive characters you might happen to have that might be carried to another generation that could say that maybe you'll die of heart disease at whatever age that might be. Clearly, some things are in your genes. James Watson, one of those discoverers of the structure of DNA, says, "We used to think that our fate was in the stars. Now we know in large measure it's in our genes." And Richard Dawkins, eminent, famous for his atheism, describes that we are machines built by DNA. His purpose is to make more copies of the same DNA. That's exactly what we're here for. We are machines for propagating DNA, and the propagation of DNA is the self-sustaining process. It's every living object's sole reason for living. I find that a very depressing outlook on life. I don't know about you. It is the way in which we do pass on our characteristics from one generation to the next. But it's not, I hope, your sole reason for living. It is extremely narrow-minded, and we'll come back to Richard Dawkins maybe in a moment as well. But I want us just to draw, as we talk through this evening, one or two analogies between God and DNA. Many people see DNA as a very mysterious molecule in the same way as they see God as someone unknown and other. Don't understand it. Some people see God as being involved in our destiny, planning the future, in the same way that people see genes as somehow being involved in our personal destiny and our personal identity. And I want also to say that it's as people look at the things that God has done, they're instilled with a sense of wonder and awe. And that's something I want to instill in you this evening as we look at this wonderful molecule. Well, you never know. Here we go. So let me just give you a little bit of biochemistry so that we're talking the same language. This word gene that comes up many times. Well, a gene is a region of DNA that codes usually for a protein. Take a simple approach. And a gene can be between 1,000 and maybe 1,000,000 of those bases long, A, G, C, and T, in a very precise order. Those genes are then arranged onto chromosomes, each chromosome having thousands of genes on it. And we have 23 different chromosomes. Altogether, we have about 3 billion of these base pairs in our genomes, these letters A, G, C, and T. And every cell in your body contains exactly the same DNA. So the cells in your big toe, although they're behaving very differently, have exactly the same genetic instructions as the cells in your brain. They're behaving differently, at least I hope they are, but it is the same genetic instruction. And different genes are switched on at different times. And we know the structure of this thing in a way in which it's the very simple model here on the top right, the chemistry of it, through to those chromosomes, to the way in which it's packed within the cell itself. And we know the chemistry in which A always pairs with T and G always pairs with C, and a very nice mechanism for, if you like, copying it. If you see an A, you always put a T opposite it. If you see a G, you always put a C. And any five-year-old in nursery school could copy a piece of DNA for you on a piece of paper with those very, very simple rules. So let's skip past that. How much of it is there in your body? And it's just fascinating. If we take these 3 billion base pairs, and there's two copies of it, so that's 6 billion. It's an extremely narrow molecule, but it's extremely long. It's billions of times longer than it is wide. There's about 2 meters of DNA in every cell in your body. And they're about 10 to the power 13. That's one with 13 zeros after it, cells in your body. So if you add it all up and stretch your DNA molecules end to end, which you wouldn't do, but if you did, there's enough DNA in your body to get to the sun and back 500 times in every one of your bodies. It probably makes up for something like about 1% of your body weight, depending on how much fatty tissue that you happen to have. That's a rough estimate. What does it do? Well, DNA codes for proteins, and proteins make the molecules of life. Now, the enzymes, the very structures of your body. So DNA is responsible for doing all that. But what does it do? I think it does everything, and it does nothing. So I could put a bottle of DNA on the table, pass it round, and it would do nothing. It is just another chemical, a polymer. It only does something in the context of the cell. By itself, it is just another molecule, like salt or polythene or whatever. It's just a molecule. But within the cell, it can do some amazing things. Now, what do we know about it that helps us know something about ourselves and maybe our place in the biological kingdoms and something about the way that God has made us? The genetic code, that's how the DNA is decoded into proteins, is identical across all living organisms. There is only one genetic code. And maybe that reminds us something of our humble origins. We have the same code as a banana, or as an earthworm, or as a bacterium. The scriptures tell us that we are made from dust, and to dust we shall return. We're made of the same physical substance as the rest of the world around us. We are chemicals. And that reminds us of our very humble origins. But don't get confused that DNA dictates our destiny. And as I talk through, I want to begin to unpack some of these with you. Some people have an idea that, if you like, genes are us. We're nothing more than a bag of chemicals that behave according to physical, chemical, mathematical, biological laws. And DNA will affect the ways that we behave, the things that we do, but it doesn't determine us. Some people will make DNA itself into a god. You can't play with it. You cannot in any way modify DNA, because that's where God goes. Beware of the phrase scientists playing at God. I don't know any scientists who play. They're deadly serious, and they take their science seriously. So they don't play at God. Some people will suggest we're no more than just the sum of our genes, and we have a kind of genetic fatalism. I'll tell you through some genes in a moment for which we are subject to fatalism. Richard Dawkins rightly says, I think, DNA neither cares nor knows. DNA just is. And then he says we dance to its music, and at that point I disagree with him. We are, however, made in the image of God, whatever that means, created in his likeness. Our genomes are 98% similar to that of chimpanzees. Does that mean that chimpanzees are 98% made in the image of God? Well, 40% of our genes are similar to those in bananas. So it's a banana, 40% made in the image of God. Well, clearly, no. Right? It is that our genetic makeup does not dictate our spiritual reality, the way in which we relate to God. They are different. Our DNA does not encode our spirituality. God, after all, is spirit, not flesh and blood. We are relational. God himself is Trinity. And as the ruler of all the world, God put us in this planet as his image, as a sign of who's in charge. Rather, like the king will construct a statue that says, here's a sign that says I'm in charge. So God has put his image in us that says, here you are as stewards of this planet. But let's look at some of the things that we've learnt about DNA from the sequencing of the human genome. And some of these might almost shock you to start with. Our DNA is full of bits that don't seem to do anything. Years ago, scientists in their hubris called it junk DNA. Junk meaning I don't know what it does, so we'll say it's useless. We're now beginning to understand that it's not junk. We don't know what it does, but it's not junk. And a lot of that is highly repetitive, and it's come through viruses infecting our genomes over millions of years. And these bits get inserted in various places. So you can say, where are these insertions? And are they there in chimpanzees? Are they there in gorillas? Are they there in cows and sheep and pigs and worms and bananas? And construct family trees based on where these come. And you can do that, and you find that the sorts of family trees that you deduce are very similar, in fact, they're identical to the family trees that are produced just on the basis of looking at gross anatomy and physiology and the fossils. So we've learned our relationship to the rest of the biological kingdoms. We also find that our genes are full of things that don't do anything anymore. You know that you should eat your five a day. Do you? Yeah? Five? Yeah? I don't know what five means. Five grapes is rather different to five apples, isn't it? But you should, and the reason you need to do that is because you need vitamin C. Without vitamin C, you get scurvy. And we can't make our own vitamin C, we have to ingest it. Many other animals make their own vitamin C. If you look in our genomes, you can find a mutated version of the enzyme that would have made vitamin C. Can't make it anymore. It's as though our distant relatives could make their own vitamin C. And they lived in a fruit-rich environment. They ate their five a day, so they didn't need to make it. They took it in from their diet. The gene was redundant, and over time it was not used, and it mutated, it is still there as a molecular fossil. And you find actually the similar sort of things with receptors for smell. You'll be aware that many animals have far more pronounced senses of smell and taste than we do. And if you look in our genomes, there are many, many genes that have been mutated, no longer function, but of molecular fossils for taste and smell receptors. You can look at how we're related to each other. I won't go into the details of it, but if you look at our chromosomes compared with chimpanzees, we have 46 chromosomes, they have 48. And it turns out our chromosome 2 maps to two of their chromosomes that have stuck together. And you can see that because there are special sequences at the ends of chromosomes, called telomeres, that you find in the middle of our chromosome 2. It's as though two chromosomes in evolutionary history have stuck together. And we believe that the last common ancestor between chimpanzees and humans was about 6 million years ago. Let me skip past that. Indeed, you can look at now people have sequenced the genomes of various other old hominids like Neanderthals. And so you can see how similar is our genome to the Neanderthal genome. And it does actually seem that we have bits of Neanderthal DNA within our genomes. Now, some of those early hominids, one way or another, probably were, there was limited interbreeding. Those coming from Africa actually have very little or no Neanderthal genome, whereas those coming from Europe tend to have a little bit more of it in their genome. So one molecular archaeologist put it like this: Neanderthals are not extinct, they live on in some of us. And don't necessarily think that Neanderthals necessarily are dim and stupid brutes. Some people have actually turned it the other way around and said, I've got lots of Neanderthal in me, that means I'm big and butch, aren't I? But our genes may limit our potential, but we're much more than the sum of our genes. An article taken from the scientific magazine Nature asked the question, what genetic changes made us uniquely human? There are very few uniquely human genes. And they put it takes much more than genes to make a human. We're not made human just by our chemical genetic makeup. There's, I think, an African saying which goes, a person becomes a person through persons. It's the way in which we interact with each other, our relationships, that make us the particular special human beings that we are. DNA does nothing, as I said, except in the context of a cell. And so we as human beings are rather limited in our capacity until we start to interact with each other. And within a church context, we know that the lonely Christian is not the way it should be. We should be working together in communities of Christians, are called churches. But can I blame my genes? Come back to this. Here's a list of genetic disorders. It's a very short list compared to the many that are known. And if you have any one of those, then yes, you can blame your genes for the illness, the disorder that you might have. We look at a few of them. Some are what we call point mutations. One of those 3 billion bases goes wrong. That gets changed. And you get an inherited disease. Examples of that, things like cystic fibrosis, sickle cell anemia, thalassemia. All of those are single point mutations in the DNA. And if you've got that point mutation, you will get that genetic condition. Sometimes our genes rearrange and a bit breaks off of one chromosome and it gets put in the wrong place on another one. And genes get expressed at the wrong time, and some cancers result from that. Chronic myeloid leukemia, some lymphomas do. Some regions of DNA just start expanding. So instead of saying the cat sat on the mat, it's the cat, as though it's stuttering. And that can cause diseases. And we know that some inherited conditions, Friedreich's ataxia, Huntington's disease, motor neurone disease, some forms of that, are inherited because the DNA sequence goes wrong. But is biology our destiny? And I'm going to lead you up a little bit of a garden path for a moment before we come back. This is a paper not published in a biology journal. This is published in the International Socialist Review. Asks, is biology our destiny? Can we escape from it? The Anatomy of Politics was a paper published in the major scientific journal Nature. And they said what I think are some rather, in this one, scurrilous things that should never be published in the scientific literature. And they say an increasing number of studies suggest that biology can exert a significant influence on political beliefs and behaviours. Genes could exert a pull on attitudes concerning topics such as abortion, immigration, the death penalty, pacifism. Published in a major scientific journal. And they go on to say it is difficult to change someone's mind about political issues because their reactions are rooted in their physiology. Just think of that for the moment. Are you that determined? I mean, most scientists would not agree with that. This paper went way over the top. What, do you know people who change their minds? Right? I know people who are atheists in their teens and early 20s who are Christians subsequently. Their genetic makeup did not change in the process of doing that. You can change people's minds by virtue of argument and discussion. That's not what I meant to go to. You see, if you believe that your genes determine your future, you're unlikely to be involved in any movements for social progress. If your human nature is fixed by your genes, then changing society is going to have little effect. The problems with society, after all, lie in the genetic makeup of individuals, not in the structure of society. And so if you take that view of life, the answer to life's problems, to society's problems, is to eliminate the people who cause them, not to try and change their behaviour. So beware if you subscribe to any form of genetic determinism, that's the line that you're going down. You don't want to change social structures. Whoa. Either it works or it works too well, doesn't it? What about a gene for criminality? Are some people criminals because of their genetic makeup? Ladies, can you put your fingers in your ear a moment? Yes, there is. It's called the Y chromosome. If you look at it across species, one of the strongest correlations between any form of behaviour and genetics is maleness and criminal behaviour. 97%, I think, of the inhabitants of jails across the world are men. You can see why I asked the ladies to put their fingers in their ears a moment. But does having a Y chromosome mean that you're going to be a criminal? No. 99.99% of men are not criminals. They're as well behaved as the ladies. So I'm sorry, ladies, you can't have it. Is there a correlation? Correlations, association like that does not mean causation. Because there's an association with having a Y chromosome and being badly behaved does not mean the Y chromosome causes bad behavior. Here's something that I thought I found quite moving, almost taken from a BBC program. They looked at the genetics of something they called resilience, and I have no idea what gene they were looking at. And they identified what they called the resilience gene. And they, in this program, they brought on Simon Weston. Remember Simon Weston, who had the terrible injuries from the Falklands crisis? And they tested his genome. Did he have the resilience gene? Whatever they meant by that. And towards the end of the program, they gave him the result. And this is they're slowly building up to it. The PGO suggests actually you have the gene variant that is not associated with resilience. He doesn't have the resilience gene, yet somebody who has demonstrated tremendous resilience throughout his life. What is his reaction to that? He says, I don't know. I think probably I'm leaning towards being slightly happy about that, in the sense that it's the sort of nurture element rather than the nature element. I always wanted it to be about who I am, not what I am. It's not what happens, it's what you're prepared to do about it that counts. So his genetic makeup did not determine his personality. Can I blame my genes? No, genes can affect our potential, but we still remain responsible for our own actions. As even Richard Dawkins put it, we are the only ones who can escape from our genes. So we have doctors and social benefits and hospitals so we can tame and overthrow the tyranny of our genes. What about belief in God? Is that genetically determined? Maybe some people are they're gullible types, so they believe in God. No, they're spiritual types because they've got that sort of gene. And a book was published, I think it was in 2002, called The God Gene. It made it onto the front cover of Time magazine. It's a load of nonsense. And it's never been published in the peer-reviewed scientific literature. And he claimed he found evidence of a neurotransmitter that was a certain variant of it in people that scored highly in something called self-transcendence. And I'm not quite sure what self-transcendence meant. This was rather picked apart in Scientific American by somebody who said, actually, this accounts for absolutely nothing. It's a small variant that can mean everything from belonging to the Green Party to believing in extrasensory perception, according to one unpublished study that was unreplicated. But it does raise an interesting issue. Supposing spiritual belief is genetically encoded, a particular gene that makes people very religious, maybe fundamentalists. If you've got a few moments to spare, Google search FunVax and look at the video. It is a spoof FBI video of saying this gene product causes spirituality, so we'll construct a vaccine against that, and we'll put this vaccine into the flu virus, and we'll infect people throughout the Middle East with this modified flu virus, and then they're vaccinated against their fundamentalism. So go half of the world's problems. And it's a very convincing video, but it is, I'm relieved to say, it's a total hoax. Right? There is no correlation between genetic makeup and belief in God. In fact, here we have Francis Collins again, who emphasizes the sort of thing I said earlier on. I've evolved from being a committed atheist in my 20s to being a firm believer in my 50s. During my conversion, there is no evidence that my DNA changed. The notion that spirituality is hardwired cannot be correct. Come back to looking at DNA from a bigger picture again. I'm not going to address the question about where it came from. Well, chemists, biochemists are fascinated by how could that molecule have arisen, and to be honest, we have various theories, but none of them are particularly convincing at the moment. Where did that information come from? Well, it came by accumulative changes over time as things got stitched together and selected for. It does actually have codes within codes. You're used to seeing the structure of DNA as that double helix. I know because some of the work that I do, some regions have very unusual structures, 3 and even 4-stranded structures. So even within that code are other fascinating codes that are hidden. And you can actually assemble DNA on a molecular scale to do some very fascinating things. If you stitch a circle together and make the right bits to interact with other bits of the circle, you can pull various parts of that circle together. I thought this would be rather complicated to do until we did it in my lab. You just throw the chemicals together, mix them up, heat them up, cool them down, and what do you see when you look at it through an atomic force microscope? You see a smiley face made out of DNA. It's a remarkable molecule. Is it the inevitable genetic material? Could God have done it any other way? Here's Stephen Benner, who calls himself an astrobiologist. In other words, he's looking for life on other planets. And some years ago, he published this statement. He said, the first thing you realize when you look at DNA is it's a stupid design. In other words, a God would have made it differently from that. And he said that because, we know that DNA has negative charges on the outside. And what do negative charges do? A bit of schoolgirl, schoolboy physics, they repel each other. So it means it's hard for them to stick together. The bits in the middle are held together by things we call hydrogen bonds, which are very weak and easily broken up by the presence of water. And he says, you're trusting your valuable genetic inheritance to hydrogen bonds in water? If you're a chemist setting out to design this thing, you wouldn't do it this way. That was his original statements. And since then, he's looked at the molecule by trying to change various bits of it. The phosphates, the negative charges on the outside, stop it from collapsing in on itself. The sugars that go on that backbone. Anything else actually is a biochemical disaster. The bases themselves, A, G, C, and T, they can be changed, and we can make other ones based on that. It's got to be stable, so as to be able to generate exact replicates. And yet it's got to be stable enough that when there's a mistake, it's still faithfully copied, and that mutations get carried from one generation to the next. It can be repaired as well as copied. Whoops. So actually Stephen Benner changed his mind. He said actually it's a remarkable molecule. And he predicted if we find life on any other planet out there, it will be DNA-based life, because it is its structure, its chemistry is so remarkable. And so I want to bring something of beauty into this. For the Christian who looks up maybe at the mountains or the skies and sees beauty, I can look at some of these molecules and say, these are really beautiful. You're used to looking at maybe the model of DNA on the left. If you look down that helix from the top, looking down, that's what it looks like on the right, a thing of beauty. The way in which it's packaged together is remarkable, exquisite structures. And some of the, doesn't want to, does it? Some of the molecular structures we get for the ways in which proteins interact with it are just beautiful. I'm sorry, I have to say that there's an art form in looking at these things. It is a sense of awe and wonder. But there are questions now that we need to be asking. The Christian, well, in fact, society needs to be asking them. If we know that some things in our genomes can cause mistakes, can we correct them? And now we have the technologies to edit genomes, to, if you like, cut and paste with scissors, to find the bits that are wrong and to cut them out and replace them with something else. And you'll find a number of different technologies. The one that is very easy to do is this thing called CRISPR-Cas9. It sounds like a cooking oil, I think, but it is an abbreviation for something else. We can now modify genomes of all sorts of organisms, even modify the human genome. And sometimes these have remarkable medical benefits, which I will show you if it can come to the next slide. Oh, that's the biochemistry that you don't want to know about. So here is a... Isn't technology wonderful? There is a picture of a young girl who suffered from terminal leukemia. And they took her white cells out, and in the laboratory with some very clever experiments, modified those white cells by some of those technologies. And then they put them back into her again. And she's in remission from leukemia. And this is something I think that was published in Daily News. I think this was in the Mail. Not that you should believe everything that's in the Mail, but this is something. A remarkable medical achievement by being able to modify her genome. What about doing that for germ cells, though? Sperm and eggs, early embryos. That raises an altogether different question about what makes us human. What is the divine spark within us? And the cat is out the bag. In 2015, a group of Chinese scientists did that on an early embryo, admittedly one that had all sorts of other problems as well and could never have led to a full conception, and showed it is possible to modify the human genome. But that asks all kinds of questions for us. What about the questions of risk? This will be carried to the next generation and so on afterwards. There's something called the precautionary principle in bioethics. Take care what you do. It raises the question of what is normal? What's a normal human being? If I look around you lot here, nobody's normal, are you? I am normal. And you're freaks of nature, all of you, because you don't look like me. What is normal? Do we have a sort of genetic classism that says, you know, some people are more worthy than others because they've got better quality genes? And do we actually end up commodifying life instead of having life as being a precious thing that we experience? It's something that becomes just another commodity. So should we, if the technology allowed, should we modify the genes of an embryo that would otherwise die of a genetic disease? Maybe that's a form of healing. What about modifying the genome of somebody who was going to suffer from cystic fibrosis? Again, a form of healing. Bring it further down, though. What about modifying the genome of somebody that would suffer from a genetic disease later in life? Huntington's disease, breast cancer. What about modifying the genome of somebody for cosmetic purposes, to endow them with some other physical property, make them good athletes or good musicians, or change even their eye colour? And this is starting to tread on things, I think, where we shouldn't go. Let me skip past this. So I want to raise those as questions for you to think about. And here's Francis Collins again, that says, at the moment, we should not do this. There are too many risks involved in it, and actually, there's not very many benefits that we couldn't get from other less drastic technologies. And quite importantly, it's again asking what makes us human, what is natural. Those who suffer from disabilities ask very profound questions. What about us? We aren't so concerned about having genomes modified. We're concerned about people not discriminating against us. And that's what Thomas Shakespeare says. The voices of people living with illness and impairment need to be heard, and we want not to be discriminated against, to be treated as ordinary human beings. Can we make life? You may have seen the things in the newspaper about Craig Venter had taken a bacterium and removed its genome and put a synthetic genome in there. Life version 2.0. It wasn't actually, because it was just new DNA inserted into an old cell. But he has actually raised the question of, can we make a synthetic human genome? And what would our reaction to that be? We don't have the technology to do it, but we know at least the chemical makeup. The scientists playing God again. Should we do that sort of thing? I'd argue that we shouldn't. But what would happen if they did? What would your reaction be to somebody who was a totally synthetic human being, who just happened to have a genome that was made artificially rather than one was procreated by natural means? I want to think that they probably would be just as human as you and I. And we need to think about and get prepared for our reaction to that in advance. Just in closing, I want also to say something about the limitations of DNA. Its replication is not perfect. Mistakes happen. And it says something a little bit about the way in which God has made the world. The world has an upside and a downside, doesn't it? Fire warms, and yet it burns. Water refreshes, and yet it drowns. And similarly, mutations are the driver for evolution. They make us different from each other, and yet mutations also cause cancer. We live in a hostile environment. And you might say, eat your antioxidant. What's the latest antioxidant? Is it blueberries or goji berries or whatever it might be? We do live in a hostile environment, and one of the most damaging chemicals for our genomes actually is water. You can't live in an environment without water, and the base C gets attacked by water at a very slow rate to make a related base. Oxygen damages our genomes. Ultraviolet light damages our genomes. That's why you put sunscreen on and you don't stay out on the sunbeds for too long if you want to get the fake tan. They damage us. They cause mutations. And in 2015, the Nobel Prize for chemistry and chemistry was won for people who looked at enzymes that are repairing DNA. There are nearly 200 genes in our genomes that are responsible for repairing our DNA. And it's been calculated that in every person, every day, something between 10 to the power 16 and 10 to the power 18 mutations happen in your genome every day. Phenomenal. And yet we have these remarkable enzymes that are there looking for them, scavenging the genome all the time to see, now, what's gone wrong? Can we put it right? And occasionally it slips past that mechanism and a disease comes. Now, I've talked to you a lot about science. I've talked to you a lot about some of the wonders and the questions that DNA raises for us that as Christians we need to address, to wonder at. The mystery of it, this remarkable molecule that does some fantastic things, rather like our remarkable God, who is mysterious and yet revealed. Controlling our destiny? Well, yes and well, no. In the same way that God has the future in hand, but gives us free will in order to be able to choose right from wrong. The sense of wonder that is, we look down at this remarkable molecule in the cell, the wonder of what it does, and the God who has made us and it and the whole universe, and we wonder at that. And a sense of our own vulnerability, the fact that DNA can so easily be damaged. We are from dust, and to dust we will return, and that we're not invulnerable, if that's a word. So, I close with those pictures again, but this time a different psalm. And this is the psalm for the scientists. And I put three different translations of that verse from Psalm 111 up there. It's inscribed over the doors of the Cavendish Laboratory in Cambridge, the physics laboratory, in Latin, the original doors, because 19th century students could speak Latin. The new Cavendish Laboratory also has it inscribed above the doors, and it's in English. And it's, "Great are the works of the Lord, they are studied by all who delight in them." Two other, not translations, but transliterations, whatever we call them, of that same verse, that I don't like those sorts of versions of the Bible, but I think these are very powerful words. The Good News Bible puts it, "How wonderful are the things the Lord has made. All who delighted with them want to understand them." Or the Message, which is even looser kind of interpretation of the text, put it, "God's works are so great, worth a lifetime of study, endless enjoyment." Now, you may have suffered under science lessons in school, and it may not fill you with enjoyment. If it doesn't enjoy it, I hope at least it fills you with a sense of awe and wonder. And at that point, thank you for your attention. I'll stop there.
So are you ready for some questions?
Oh yes, I love the questions. They're the best part. The talk is just the prelude to the questions. Because you're responsible for the questions, not me.
Right. Anyone for questions? Okay.
Hi. Firstly, thank you for your talk. It was illuminating and really enjoyable. I work with artists and musicians who have learning disabilities. And I was really interested to hear what you had to say about people with disabilities and about their genetic makeup. And I think taking a point that you referred to at the beginning, that Richard Dawkins said about our DNA is a machine for replicating itself, and we're that machine. I have always found him to be quite an offensive and despicable character.
He's not the worst.
He's not the worst. Oh, that's...
I'll tell you one in a minute.
That's challenging. I wonder what he would say about people with disabilities. Does that mean that their DNA is failing because it, in many cases, can't replicate itself? And on a similar but unrelated note, are people who are homosexual, therefore, in possession of DNA that doesn't want to replicate itself?
Right, so there's a number of different questions. Thank you for that, embedded within.
Just one to append as well. As far as I know, at some point, the Y chromosome will fail. I've heard it's about 200,000 years, and does that mean that our DNA effectively stops replicating en masse at that point? Thank you.
So to take the easy one first, the homosexuality, there is no gene for homosexuality. It may be genetically influenced. It may be a whole series of genomes come together to influence that. Always beware, if you read in the newspapers, scientists discover a gene for. The reason it's got in the newspaper usually is because the scientists' funding is about to run out, and they want to highlight that how important their research is. So there is no single gene for homosexuality. I think the jury is out as to whether there are a whole series of genes together that influence that. In terms of DNA people's worth, Richard Dawkins, I think, has been on record as recommending to somebody who was screened and shown to have an unborn child that was going to have Down syndrome, said, well, you should get it aborted. Right? They're a drain on society. And I think that is awful. So we value people according to what they can contribute to society, and some people are inevitably going to be a drain on society's resources. Some of us fall ill and we are costly, and some of us live very healthy lives and never have to resort to the NHS. And we live together as people. We're all of us dependent. My friend John Wyatt put it like this, is that when you come into this world, you are utterly dependent. And when you go out from this world, you're utterly dependent on other people. And we have a dependency culture that says, if you can't be independent, you're worthless. No. Each of us are dependent on other people, some to more extent than others. The question you asked about DNA being our destiny and our sole purpose in living. Somebody who is worse than Richard Dawkins is Peter Atkins, who is a chemist in Oxford, is a very clever chemist and has written the best thermodynamics book that has tortured generations of students, because thermodynamics is not easy. I'm told of a debate that he once had where a sixth former asked him pointedly, so Professor Atkins, what is the purpose of life? And he replied, the purpose of life is to pass on your genes. And somebody then pointed out that he was without any children and past normal childbearing age. Does that mean that his life was purposeless? Having children is immensely fulfilling, and I have three children who are now flown the nest, so I live a rather more peaceful life. I can see why people really are desperate for children, because it does give an added complexity to life. But it is not the meaning of life. It's possible to live a totally fulfilled human life and not pass your genes on to the next generation. Now, I'm sure there's a question embedded within that I haven't answered. Oh, the Y chromosome. Yeah, the Y chromosome is... It doesn't recombine in the way in which other chromosomes do. So in other words, it just gets passed from one generation to the next. And that it is probably the most degenerate of all our chromosomes, full of the greatest number of errors. People have estimated if that frequency carries on, that it's destined to be finished. But on the other hand, you need a Y chromosome, even with all our technologies. You do need a man and a woman to procreate. Even if it's done in vitro. So there will be still that self-selection within that, that without the Y chromosome, we're finished as a species, unless we do absolutely everything totally artificially. So I don't hold that pessimism for it. I think it's still essential.
James? Almo?
Yes.
Oh, sorry.
I'm intrigued how this mysterious thing called I exists in all of this. Because in the midst of all the changes that are constantly going on with us, I am still here. And I am aware that I'm still here. So what is really the connection between, is this I, what we would call a soul, which is in the midst of all this, in the midst of all this change, and is affected by it in certain ways. But I like your statement about person, so much about the relationships that we have with each other, so much influences who we are as persons. But I'm fascinated by the I.
Right, so let me address it on a number of levels. Firstly, is we don't understand. Scientists shouldn't be ashamed of actually saying, I don't know. I'll go away and see if we can find out more ways of finding out. It is the big question, if you like, consciousness. Who is the me? We can do a lot of the biochemistry. So vision, for instance. We know the physics of the eye. We understand the genetics of it, how it's put together. We understand how it might have evolved. We can look at the biochemistry, the signaling pathways, the nerves that take it through to various optic centers. We can do all that, but yet we have no idea who is the me that does the seeing. What really is consciousness. So there is something more profound than just our DNA structure. Now, remind me, you pointed another part to that question, which is slipped through my aging brain. Was there another part to that? Oh, the... Yes. Okay. Yes, I'm with you now.
Our bodies, as I age, we mind is not very well, so well, etc. But in fact, there's always this consciousness, isn't there?
Yes, it is, and we still remain as valuable human beings, irrespective of what damage might have happened. Those who suffer from serious Alzheimer's disease, where their personality may have changed as well as their memory, are still valued human beings. The baby who can do nothing but just sit and gurgle, you know, might amuse a grandparent who goes, ah. But actually, what use is a baby? It has a lot of potential use, I heard down here, and indeed it does. So we're in that danger of valuing people according to what they do, not just as people in themselves. So I think that's a really important point. And also the point about we become people by interacting with others. If you deprive young children of interaction with others, they're emotionally deprived. They're starved of relationships. And we're made for relationships with each other. And the things that we do, the things that we experience in life, actually affect our genomes. I didn't touch on the whole subject of epigenetics, which you might have heard of. That's another buzzword that goes out there, which is our genomes are modified according to the sorts of things that we eat, the things that we do, so that the sequence remains the same, but various chemical tags are put on that DNA. And we know that we are creatures of habit, so that if you practice a musical instrument, you get better and better and better at it. If you are a London taxi driver, you have certain parts of your brain that are... larger than average, because you've adapted to incorporate those spatial maps of London in the way in which I get lost in even the smallest of towns. So we are, our whole bodies are affected by the things that we do, and they're affected by the people that we interact with, the relationships that we have, and that's what really makes us people, is the way in which we talk to each other, we interact with each other, the dynamic of being affected by other people. So thank you for that point. I think it's really important. And there's a question here.
Thank you, sir. I just wanted clarification on a phenomenon called disengagement in health work, where you have some patients who are resilient and a will to live, and they seem to pull through. Mm. And you meet other patients who give in very easily. And I'm wondering, what can a carer do in order to inject an enthusiasm for life in individuals who are disengaging?
Yes, I mean, it's way outside my expertise on that, but it is quite clear that people's attitude does affect, to some degree, their outcomes. And there's a whole lot of reasons for that. I think some of the attitude affects the chemical transmitters in the brain, and that we're whole people. That doesn't mean to say if you're suffering from a terminal disease that you necessarily will get better from it if you have the right attitude, but that you may live longer because your body is responding in a different way. You may be an entirely happier kind of person. And I think actually for the Christian as well, it's quite important that we pray for people, and that when people are ill, they're prayed for, and they know that they're being prayed for. And that may not result in any biochemical difference, any miraculous change in that person. But in a sense of their well-being does affect that. Now, if I say that I'm praying for you, and I hope that actually gives you a sense of worth, makes you feel more valued, and that your mental processes change and your body's physiology in some small way changes as a result of that. We aren't just... simple linear biochemical chains. We are integral as humans. So yes, people's attitude to disease can affect the outcome from the person who says, well, that's it, to those who say, well, I'm going to fight against this. It does make a difference. Now, what is the cause of why some people are optimistic and other pessimistic is way outside my pay grade to begin to explain that. But it clearly is an effect. Thank you.
Yes, I've got a question. I've got the microphone as well. I've got a scientific background, and I sort of fully believe in evolution, and that obviously that means that we are linked to all the other animals in the kingdom. And but what I would like to know from you is, what can you say to Christians who just don't believe any of the evolution thing and just think we are completely separate? What can you say?
The trivial answer is you're wrong, but that doesn't help anybody to say that. There are amongst Christians a diversity of opinions, and a view on human origins is not foundational to Christian belief. A view that God is the creator is foundational, so that all that there is made by an almighty God. Whether he made that 6,000 years ago or made the universe 13.8 billion years ago, I think it's a very interesting scientific point, and one that science is very clear on. But the fact that God is the creator is the important thing. The fact that we're made in God's image is important. How that image came to be is interesting, it's important, but it's not a primary importance. The primary importance is that we are made in God's image. We can relate to him. We are people who understand right from wrong. We are conscious, sentient beings. So for that sort of person, and I know some of them, we just agree to disagree, and let's focus on the things that we can agree on that are fundamental to the Christian faith. I recently had I'll share with you a speaking engagement withdrawn in a church because they understood that I supported evolution and they couldn't have a speaker who that. And I thought it was very sad because they'd made a fundamental of belief into something that's not a fundamental. The fundamental for a Christian is that this is God's world and that Jesus Christ is God revealed to us, who lived and died and rose again that our sins might be forgiven. Those are the key parts of the Christian faith, and take away any of those and then I'll part company with you and we'll have an almighty row. How did God do the creating? Was it a long time? It's important to me as a scientist, but as a Christian it's of secondary importance. Does that begin to answer your question? And there are a whole lot of theories out there, even for those who take evolutionists, who were Adam and Eve? When did God's image appear in us? And science actually is fairly silent on that. So there is speculation, but we always have to be careful about when the fine line between speculation and dogma. Science is silent over when we actually became spiritual beings. So we can speculate in the light of scripture, in the light of the science we know, but it remains a speculation. There are a few books I think I put on the table out there for sale. One, some of you may have come across, Creation or Evolution, Do We Have to Choose? By Dennis Alexander, which goes through a whole of evolutionary mechanisms and has a number of chapters on there about Adam and Eve and what does it mean to be made in God's image, which they're for sale out there. I think they're £9 each, those, which is a discount price.
Time for one more question. So we've got two people.
Thank you. You briefly talked about epigenetics. Now, is epigenetics taken as seriously as real genetics? Or is it, as some people say, it's a little bit of a... on the outside at the moment, it isn't scientific enough.
No, actually within science itself, within the whole biological community, it is taken very seriously. It's still a black box to some extent as to how epigenetics work. We know about some of the modifications on the histones, the acetylation that takes place on some of them. We know about the methyl groups that are tagged onto DNA. So we know some of the chemical principles. How that leads through then to the epigenetic phenomena is it's a black box, but it's clear there it is there. Industry is very interested in it. So there's a whole new discipline called nutrigenomics, which you can get. The food industry is very keen on that. How does the food that you eat affect your genome? And how does your genome deal with the kinds of different foods that you eat? And of course, they can see money in this and investing in it to advise people what to eat. So yeah, epigenetics is undoubtedly real. It's an area that is being vigorously researched in many laboratories. It's true, we don't understand the precise mechanisms behind much of it, but it's there, and it's a field that's ready to be explored. Thank you for the question.
Okay, one last question.
Thanks very much. Thank you. You said that you weren't, you didn't want to go into where it came from, but I find that very fascinating because it's immensely complicated. And you said there are a number of theories. Could you give us just a feeling of whether those theories are very well advanced and credible, or how far away we might be from being able to say, well, where that came from?
There are a number of theories, as I said. It's at what level you want to ask. Once you've got a small piece of DNA, or rather RNA, which is a chemical cousin of DNA, we know that it's possible to have primitive life forms that don't have proteins. So the RNA itself does all the work. It's a genetic material as well as acting all the enzymic properties as well. And you can get small pieces of RNA that copy themselves, that can expand in terms of size. So once you've got to that, you can imagine how that can spiral, and then eventually over time RNA starts to cooperate with primitive proteins, and then the cooperative process takes place there. So that's one level of explanation for which I think we have very good scientific evidence. The more difficult one is the question, where did the nucleic acid, the DNA and RNA, come from in the first place? They're simple chemicals, but not trivial to make. And quite how in that, if you like, primordial soup, to use a phrase that I don't like, but in that that primitive environment, how did those first DNA molecules assemble? And there are ideas about the ways in which molecules could have been absorbed onto mineral surfaces, where in the high concentrations on the surface, various bits of chemistry are possible. But I think at the moment it is just speculation. In terms of the word evolution, just to get that clear, evolution itself does not ask the question of where did it come from. It says, how has it changed over time? So there are, if you like, two questions, and quite often people get confused with that. Evolution says, how are things related together once we've got the whole thing started? But there is a very profound question of saying, how did it start in the first place? Some people will say, well, God did it. I'm hesitant of using that God of the gaps type approach that says, because I don't understand it, God must have done it. Because now, a few years down the line, some wonderful chemist will say, well, actually, I've got the mechanism. Personally, I suspect we will never know, not in this life anyway. I think we can't wind the clock back. We don't know what the primitive conditions would have been. So I suspect it might always be one of those imponderables. But it's still worth looking at. Now, that's the fun thing about science. You take something you don't know and you beaver away at it. You see, can I find out a little bit more? Can I get another hypothesis? So we don't know. Thank you.
Hello. Thank you very much, Keith, for a fascinating talk to us, and I think more questions.